As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I want to zoom out and talk about this question on whether science and faith are compatible. And I think the reason that that I was asked to talk about this topic is that many of us have some intuitions that there might be a problem there, that they might not be compatible. And here, I'm going to go back and forth, sort of dimming the light, because here you need to be able to see. So half of the screen is lighter than the other half. So you're going to have to take my word for it that in this fabulous painting of Galileo standing up to the Dominicans, that there's like a slight sort of halo around Galileo as he's standing up for reason against the prejudices of faith here, nicely illustrated by three slightly dour-looking Dominicans. So I think when most of us, like where this intuition comes from, I would propose that it is often from illustrations like this, rather than thinking deeply about what these conflicts might actually be and whether we agree with the reasons behind them. So we are not going to be thinking about or like looking at too many of these pieces of art. We're instead going to try to apply our reason to these questions and think through what kind of conflicts could we come up with. So follow our great teacher, St. Thomas Aquinas, and try to make as strong of a case as possible for that there might be a conflict, and obviously walk through them and see if we can resolve those proposed conflicts. And when I have been talking about science and faith in different contexts, the kind of objections that come up, why you would say that it's, that science and faith are not compatible, I think can loosely be grouped in four different categories, which I have named here intrinsic, doctrinal, psychological, and sort of institutional or historical, and I would say roughly in that order of importance. So I think about intrinsic kind of conflicts. What would they be? They would be things such as the scientific project or scientific method has disproven the existence of God. Miracles and other supernatural events are not compatible with science. That would be another sort of intrinsic objection. Or that natural and supernatural explanations are sort of intrinsically in conflict with one another. So we're going to have to go and look at those. And if those are, like if there's a conflict there, you're basically done. I mean, those you can't really work around. The second one would be, I think, where actually the conflicts are most often show up in media or in the public discourse, would be what I would say is doctrinal or biblical. So here's where you would have sort of specific scientific results or teachings seemingly coming into conflict with scientific truths or facts regarding the origins of the universe, the origins of life, evolution, origins of humans. So we'll talk about those. And of course, as Catholics, these are also very serious since we believe in an infallible teaching office. The third one that I call psychological, which is basically that there is a conflict between the use sort of reason and having faith, which means that if you are a person of faith, you are not going to be a very good scientist. So think about, you might have heard someone like Dawkins or some other of the new atheists say something along the lines that, well, if you come up to sort of a scientific mystery, something that is sort of unexplained about how the world works, and you always have the option to say, God did it, that's not going to make you a very good scientist. So that would be in sort of fall in the third category. And then the final one, which I called historical or institutional, here it's going to be more of a question of saying, well, whatever answers you come to on these sort of more foundational ways that you could have a conflict between science and religion, if history is showing us that something like the Catholic Church has over and over again been an obstacle to scientific progress, well, shouldn't we just look at the historical facts rather than sort of our philosophical theories? So we also want to investigate whether there is this, whether this sort of mythical battle between science and religion, especially between sort of Western scientific revolution and the Catholic Church, is real or not. And this would be, the Galileo affair would be sort of the most visible of those conflicts in this supposed battle that has been going on for a couple of thousand years. So these are the objections. The church, however, very confidently teaches that there is no intrinsic conflict between faith and reason, between science and religion. Famous quote by Saint Pope John Paul II, that faith and reason are like the two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. So first of all, the truth there is in the singular. So there is one source of the truth. There are these two ways to try to approach it. But since they are sort of directed towards the same source of the truth, they cannot in principle be at conflict. So this is sort of at the core of the Catholic teaching. So we're going to have to see if that's where we end up at the end of this lecture. But we want to have that in the back of our mind as we start thinking through these objections and how we could possibly resolve them. So let's start with the intrinsic ones. So are science and faith intrinsically compatible? If you're reading the slide, you'll see that I inserted something there, which is Christian faith. If you want to make the claim that there is never any conflict between faith commitments and the scientific project, you will have a hard time. You can absolutely think about religious claims or religious faith commitments that could come in direct conflict with the scientific project. And if you want to get into some of those during the Q&A, happy to do that. So we're going to focus here on sort of classical Christianity as embodied by the Catholic tradition. And it should come to no surprise, I think, to you that I'm going to come down on the no side of that as a scientist and a practicing Catholic. But if that is the case, like, why do we often sort of get the sense that there is some intrinsic conflict? And I would say it has to do with either sort of a fragmented or poor understanding of what science does, or a faulty view of what sort of classical Christianity has meant with faith and with God. So let's start. So I think it's worth taking just a few minutes to think about what science actually is as a process, and therefore what kind of answers that you can answer, or like what kind of answers you can get to with the scientific method. So the classical way to think about the scientific method is illustrated by this circle, which is that it starts with that you have some question. And since I'm an astronomer, it would be there will be a couple of astronomy examples in this talk, even if there won't be any astrochemistry. So the question could be, like, you're curious people with minds ordered towards the finding out the truth of the world around you, could be on a sunny evening like this, is to ask yourself, why does the sun shine? What powers the sun? People have been asking that for a long time. The next thing you do as a scientist is to try to figure out as many things that are already known about the object as you can think of. And there are, of course, many ways to do that, but there you could do things like trying to figure out how much energy is coming from the sun that's landing here on Earth, and therefore how much energy in total must the sun be irradiating over time. You can try to figure out what different ways that you know of here on Earth that you can produce energy and see if any of them could be applicable to the sun. And then you come up with a hypothesis. And I would say the most natural hypothesis, if you look at something as bright and sort of yellow-orange like the sun, it looks like it's on fire, is that you have the hypothesis, maybe the sun is a giant fire, like a giant candle. And then you have done a little bit of chemistry, so you know that what fire is here on Earth is converting one kind of chemical substance to another. It's a chemical reaction. And then you try to test whether this is actually possible. Maybe you count up how many molecules you would need to destroy over the lifetime of the Earth to power the sun over the lifetime of the Earth. If you do that, you will quickly run into a problem, which is that even if the whole sun was sort of packed with molecules and you broke and formed every single bond there in as favorable way as possible, you could only power the sun for sort of thousands to 100,000 years. That was fine up until sort of the 19th century when we started to realize that the Earth is much older than that, actually in the 18th century, late 18th century. And we needed a new way to explain the sun. And probably, as most of you know, the hypothesis that we eventually landed on is that it's not the breaking and forming of molecules that's powering the sun, but it's the pulling together of atoms, of hydrogen atoms, to form helium. And if you now do the math, you can find out that there's enough hydrogen in the sun to power it for about 10 billion. Which is great because we are about 5 billion years. So that's how this circle of science, and it is in this sort of, in some sense, very narrowness and modest approach that has made science so incredibly successful in explaining the material world around us. That we insist on this feedback back and forth between sort of our minds and this very tangible reality around us, and a ways of like sending out ideas and testing them against hard data, and that you only call something a result if you can get at it with many different kinds of observations or many other kind of different kinds of data. That's what has allowed us to figure out so many things about the universe, about the Earth here, about atoms and molecules and energy that powers a lot of the technological society that we live in. This, however, this very narrow scope is sometimes what science does. Well, it's narrow if you think there could be something more than the material order around us. Is also, though, what makes it profoundly the wrong instrument to answer the question of does God exist or not. This is especially true if we have the kind of understanding of who God is as has been developed within the Christian intellectual tradition, where God is not something in the world that we can measure and poke at. He is not the one being among many, like not even a very impressive being among many here that you could, in theory, maybe go after with some measurements. Rather, he is being himself. This is famously recorded in Exodus when Moses asks for a name so he can go and explain to the Israelites who it is that is sending him. And God gives this very mysterious answer, I am who am. Tell the Israelites that I am has sent you. This is something that the medievals, St. Thomas Aquinas, among others, took to like refine the understanding of that to mean that God is existence in himself, that his very essence is existence. He is being, and we are sort of just beings in a derivative sense. This means that God is completely outside of the material order and therefore cannot be measured or discovered or disproven with the scientific method. The second intrinsic, or I put it as an intrinsic one, is whether there is an intrinsic conflict between science and miracles. Now, miracles are not important for all religions. But as we are preparing for Easter, it is at the core of Christianity. So there are some religions where this would not be an intrinsic issue, but Christianity is one where if you have an intrinsic conflict between science and the existence of miracles, again, you're in trouble. And as you can tell, even though I have no formal training in Thomism, I am sort of a Thomist at heart in that I really like to list things in an orderly fashion. So three different objections that have all been sort of sub-objections, so we're now in an article on this sort of greater question, that have often been brought up if they're, whether miracles are compatible with science. It's on the one hand that the existence of laws of nature, scientific laws, that the fact that they exist, that they disprove miracles. Second one, that there's never sufficient reason to believe in miracles, so that means that you are unreasonable if you believe in miracles. And then in the third one, that science could not work if miracles is an acceptable explanation. So let's just briefly, since we're going to try to pack in a lot tonight, go through each of them. So the first ones, does the existence of law contradict miracles? Well, think about what you're saying there. Like, you're somehow saying that there is a law that you're treating based like a human law. Somebody like made this law that is not possible to break. That sounds a lot like you are now invoking some kind of deity that made that law in the first place. If you do not think that there is a God, then you have no reason to think that there are actual laws of nature. You can talk about that there are sort of patterns in nature, that there seems to be causal powers in things, but you cannot really assert that there are unbreakable laws. So already here, there seems to be somewhat of a built-in contradiction. But if we believe that there are laws and that there is an author of those laws, then that author can also providentially act in creation through sort of direct action rather than through sort of the typical means of acting through the causal powers of created things. And when we come to number three, we'll talk more about why he might want to do that. But there's nothing, if we think that God is the lawgiver, that he has the powers to give causality or real causal powers to created things, there's nothing that would stop him from then being able to also act directly in his creation. In fact, the latter seems to be much easier than to create this whole sort of web of natural laws that we seem to have to find. The second one is, this is the argument of Hume, that there's never sufficient reason to believe in miracles. I don't want to say much more about it than, of course, there can be sufficient reason to believe in miracles. If you want to be as skeptical as Hume wants you to be about miracles, that you're never going to accept what seems like a miraculous event, even if it's happening to yourself. I mean, if Hume is very strict, he would say that if you break your arm, somebody prays over that arm, and it miraculously heals, it is more reasonable to believe that you yourself are hallucinating than that you just witnessed a miracle. But if you think that you cannot even trust your own senses to record sort of events around you, it becomes very difficult to do science and to discover sort of new and unexpected scientific patterns as well. Third one, science cannot work if miracles take place. So this in some sense is a variant of the Dawkins kind of argument that you can't really do science if you're a person of faith, because you can always bring in the God explanation. Here it would be something like, let's say I'm pointing my observatory towards stars, and then sort of the miracle demon decides to randomly sort of add in stars just when I'm observing them and then take them away again. And because of that, I'm going to derive all the wrong laws of physics. So if you believe in sort of a miracle demon that is sort of randomly adding things, it would be pretty hard to do science. However, that is not how miracles have been understood in the Christian tradition. Rather, miracles are signs of God's providence that act to show his providential governance of the world, as testimony for example, who Jesus is, or to restore creation and sometimes have it working as it's supposed to be. Think about healing miracles as falling into that category. And rather than having miracles saying that you can't do science if there are miracles, or that scientific progress prevents miracles from happening, miracles are really only possible at science because we first have natural knowledge of what typically happens. If it was pretty random whether human beings could walk on water or not, it would not be a great sign when Jesus was walking on water over his sort of providential power over not just the waters of this lake, but of the sort of the stormy waters in general, which harkens back to Genesis. Third, intrinsic possible conflict. Are supernatural and natural explanations compatible? So here, we need to take just a small step back and think about what we mean by sort of natural explanations and divine or supernatural explanations. And there is a very useful concept that in sort of classical medieval Catholic thought about primary versus secondary causality. So with primary causality, what we mean is this is the causality of God. This is primary, not just that it's like first in time, but it undergirds all action. So God is always acting. He is always a cause. Now, he can be if he acts just in his own power, that's when we have basically a miracle, or we get something like the human soul being created. But God also acts through secondary causes, through instrumental causes. These are things like people, animals, natural forces, and so on, which have real causal powers, but they are dependent on the primary causality of God. This means because these acts at such different levels, like the God's causality and creaturely causality, and sort of the normal operations of things, this means that they cannot, in principle, be in competition with one another. I think one way that is like easier for us to see that is to think about a human author. So we'll take my favorite, Tolkien, and think about whatever favorite character that you might have in Lord of the Rings. And if you haven't read it or seen it, you should. I'm going to pick one of mine. I really like Faramir. Now, if you saw the movie, they did not treat him well. So we're gonna think about Faramir and the original. And you can ask the question, who in the Lord of the Rings, who decided to not take the ring from Frodo? One very reasonable answer to that would be Faramir. That is what his doing in the story. He's showing that it is possible to resist the power of the ring. But another equally good answer would be Tolkien. Like this, saying that Tolkien and Faramir are competing causes would be less ridiculous than saying that God and creatures are competing causes. So, I realized that we went through a lot of things, but let's say that we have sort of come to the conclusion that there probably aren't any sort of deep intrinsic philosophical reasons that science and Catholic religion, the Catholic religion or Catholic faith, are not compatible with one another. What about specific doctrines, though? And here, when we're thinking about conflicts between science and Christianity, most of the time we think about how to read Genesis. So it's especially the first sort of 2.5 chapters of Genesis in terms of how we understand the origin of everything, everything around us. So I want to focus on sort of three short passages in Genesis that I think is where a lot of these supposed conflicts come up. And again, pretty quickly, walk through some reasons why I think that they are not actually real conflicts. And we'll start at the very beginning. So in the beginning, when God created heavens and earth, it is a pretty clear message from this first verse that God created the universe, everything there is. That is also a dogmatic teaching of the church. And here, the supposed conflict. So this is a strong sort of doctrinal teaching. So here, the possible conflict would be between this sort of theological truth on the one hand, and this amazing scientific discovery of how of the Big Bang and its relation to the universe today. So the Big Bang cosmology. So that is the favorite cosmology of today. And even if you have seen some articles about some aspects of it being challenged by new observations, at its core, it is a very stable scientific theory, even if there are some things that are going to need some refinement. So what the Big Bang theory of our universe tells us is that the whole visible universe was once about 14 billion years ago in this extremely hot and dense state, scales that are smaller than an atom, like for our whole visible universe. So unimaginably hot and dense. Out of this state, it rapidly expanded and then settled into a slower expansion rate. And as the universe cooled down, first you have the sort of different natural forces separating, then you have atoms coming together, you have atoms and light separating and starting their sort of separate journeys, eventually start forming stars and galaxies. And I said around sort of 10 billion years into that development, our star and solar system forms in our galaxy, the Milky Way. So we're sitting now over here. So is this scientific discovery, which is backed up by a lot of data as well as sort of sound physical reason, in contradiction with this teaching that God created the universe? Well, it can't be, because when the Big Bang starts, there's already something there. Like, the Big Bang is telling us nothing about how the universe came into existence. It is telling us a whole lot about the early development of this universe and how it came to look the way that it looks today. This also means it has sort of, there's the reverse part of that, which is that trying to prove the beginning of the universe or creation out of nothing from the existence of the Big Bang is also going to be somewhat of a, let's say, unstable proof for God's existence. So there's just a fundamental sort of metaphysical difference between what the Big Bang cosmology is teaching us and what creation out of nothing, this Catholic teaching says. So as I said, it is a teaching of the church that the whole universe is created out of nothing by God. But there is sort of a complementary understanding of creation, which I think is the deepest levels they actually merge, which is that creation should not primarily be seen as sort of an event that happened 14 billion years ago, if that was sort of the moment of creation or nothing right before the Big Bang. But rather, it is primarily a relationship, that it is what creation describes is the very dependency of the created act of being upon the principle from which it is produced. And thus, creation is a kind of relation. So this is Thomas Aquinas. This distinction also means that there cannot be any possible, like there is no possibility of conflict between creator and creation because you have this relationship of dependency. There's a fun quote from Thomas Aquinas about why did God create the universe with a beginning? Aquinas thinks that God could have created a universe without a beginning. But he thinks that it is one of the reasons that God created a universe with a beginning is that a thing that has a beginning, it's more self-evident that that needs a cause for its existence. I think it's wonderful that Aquinas said that long before we had any evidence of that the universe has a beginning, where we only had basically the revelation. And now, and I can't help but it's like one of these providential gifts that right as sort of the atheism was taking over the academy, we were basically gifted with this scientific theory of the Big Bang, which I said is not identical to creation out of nothing, but it's as good of an icon of creation as I think anyone could imagine. Okay, but next step. So we'll go a little bit further in Genesis, where we get to read that then God said, let the earth bring forth vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree on earth that bears fruit with its seed in it. And so it happened. You might have noticed that I bolded a portion of it. So here we're not talking about creation. Here it says, let the earth bring forth. Which is, I think, interesting intuition in the author of Genesis. So what is the possible conflict? Well, so there are scientific ideas. They're not theories, because we don't actually have a good explanation, but scientific ideas of how we could go from a chemical, like a universe full of chemistry, and turn that chemistry into life. We're pretty far from figuring out if that is like how that would actually happen. And there is not consensus among Catholic scientists whether that is something that could naturally happen or whether you need sort of direct divine intervention. I'm in the camp that I think it could happen naturally and that we will one day figure it out. But it is right now just a scientific idea, which in some sense already removes some of the possibility, like some of these of the present day possibility of conflict. But I think it's still good to ask ourselves, well, if scientists find out that you can, that the origins of life here on Earth had a was natural, happened through the laws of chemistry, would that be a conflict? And then, of course, we have, we know that our, how information is transferred from one generation to another is through the genetic code, and that there are many pieces of converging scientific evidence of evolution of that early life into the sort of abundance of life forms that we see today, and that somehow through evolution we didn't just form new life forms, but we also in each of us like this formed cells that are incredibly complex and impressive. So there's just a short movie showing you motor proteins as an scientifically correct illustration of what's going on in your cells at all times. These little proteins carrying this sort of ballast across these ropes inside of your cells. This is also why some people think that origins of life might have been too complicated to happen naturally, because this is just an incredible machinery. So do we have a conflict here? There is a long tradition within the church of reading Genesis not as a historical text, but to trying to pick out what are sort of the major theological themes and messages that are in it. Aquinas very famously focused in on that we really have three different kinds of events happening in Genesis. We have the creation. So this is the creation of the whole material and immaterial order. But after that, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. There are basically 3 days where he pulls things apart and distinguishes them from one another. So light and darkness, the waters and the earth, heaven and earth. And then there's another 3 days of adorning these different now distinct portions of the world. And that is in some sense that we have that God's providential care is in all three. You have about 800, 900 years earlier, you have Augustine, if you have ever read anything of his literary commentary on Genesis, I think you will be quite surprised of what Augustine means by the literal meaning of Genesis. He spends a good number of pages just asking the question, what does in the beginning mean? And gives like 10 different possible explanations of those first words. But what he famously says a bit further in is that in the first creation, so at the moment of creation, all things were created. But all things were not necessarily created in their present form. Like also causes and seeds of things to come in the future. So we have from sort of the earliest sort of patristic tradition, ideas about that it is possible from reading Genesis carefully to see that that's compatible with sort of a developing creation. That it doesn't have to be the same at all times. And I think if you take that together, and again, paying attention even to the text of Genesis, it is not at all obvious that there should be any conflict between how we think about the ordinance of life and evolution and what Genesis says. But then we have the final portion, which is God created. And now we are back with created. Mankind in his image, in the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So what are we to make of that? There is a lot, again, of converging evidence that the human body came about through evolution, that we are just biologically closely related to all living things here on Earth, which I actually think is really beautiful. So when we sort of St. Francis can say, Brother Wolf, like we really can say Brother Wolf. But there is a big but to that. And this is from Pope Pius XII. That the teaching authority of the church does not forbid that in conformity with the present state of human sciences and sacred theology, research and discussions take place with regard to the doctrine of evolution in as far as it inquires into the origin of the human body as coming from pre-existent and living matter. This is still the teaching of the church. Church does not take a stand on whether this is a correct scientific teaching or not. But the Catholic faith obliges us to hold that souls are immediately created by God. So when we think about why is the word created, again, used in Genesis, that is what the church teaches us that it's there for. If you go into Genesis 2, you actually have a very beautiful, I think, image of Adam being sort of molded out of the dirt of the earth, and then the soul breathed into him. And I think that's another image that must have been, I think, in the back of the head of Pope Pius XII here. Okay, so we have gone through 2 out of 4, but we're going to speed up a little bit with the last 2, because that's where we come to things that I think are not as foundational. Are science and faith psychologically or methodologically compatible? And here, there are many things you could point to why they are, the many Catholic scientists that have made great contributions. The fact that even in our normal lives, it is perfectly rational to believe things on authority or believe credible witnesses. But I think it's always nice to talk about something concrete. So I want to take a couple of minutes and talk about the origin of the Big Bang Theory. So if we go back about 100 years, Edwin Hubble and collaborators were starting to have good enough telescopes to be able to not just see that there were other galaxies than our own, but that those galaxies had different colors. Some seemed redder, some bluer. Also around the same time, some astronomers at Harvard discovered a way to measure how far away galaxies were, and particularly a woman named Henrietta Swan Leavitt. And what Hubble started to see was that galaxies, like it was not random what color galaxies had, but rather the further away a galaxy was, the redder it seemed. One way to interpret what was going on is that the further away a galaxy was, the faster it was moving away from you, sort of stretching the wavelength of the light and making it redder. So that was one thing that was going on. Around the same time, Albert Einstein was reimagining what the physical universe is like through his theory of general relativity. But one of the problems with a theory of general relativity that describes the curvature of space, of the universe as a whole, it was quite difficult to get the universe to stay put, to be static. And this was a problem because everyone knew that the universe was static, that the universe was infinite in time, had always been the same. So Einstein famously put an extra constant into his equations to make it static. But this didn't work for very long, because first a Belgian priest, Father Lemaître, showed that even with that constant in place, you actually would get the dynamical universe. And once he realized you have a dynamical universe, and also he did his PhD at MIT next to Harvard, so he knew about many of the astronomical observations that were going on at the time, and he started to put two and two together. And what he came up with was this radical idea that the universe, if galaxies were moving away from one another right now, it was because the whole space universe was expanding. And that means that if you look back in time, you should come to a point where the universe is basically infinitely dense and small. He called this the primeval atom. This was not met with a lot of enthusiasm at first, this idea. Many of his contemporaries thought that this sounded awfully much like Catholic doctrine rather than science. And of course, it didn't help that he had a collar. And it took several decades for like the community as a whole to come to the consensus that this was the best explanation of the universe that we had. Now, Father Lemaître had a lot of natural things going for him. He had deeply versed in mathematics and physics, sort of the modern physics, the new physics. He was sort of at the right time and place to hear about the new astronomical observations. But I also can't help but think that this idea must have occurred to other scientists as well at the time, but that it must in some way have helped Father Lemaître to not dismiss that idea in knowing that the beginning of the universe was a possibility, and like a changing universe over time was a possibility. And Father Lemaître was very careful about keeping, in some sense, his science and his theology in respecting the different methods of the two disciplines. But he did write a couple of things about sort of the life as a Catholic scientist. And I really like this quote, what precedes it is that also he will say that, of course, you can be good scientist and not be Christian. Einstein would be sort of exhibit A on that. But what he says is, therefore, the Christian scientist goes forward freely, secure in the knowledge that his research cannot conflict with his faith. He has perhaps even a certain advantage over his non-believing colleague. Indeed, both are striving to decipher the manifold complexity of nature in which the various stages of the world's long evolution are overlaid and confused. But the believer has the advantage of knowing that the enigma is solvable, that the underlying scripture is, after all, the work of an intelligent being. That for Lemaître, the fact that he knew that the created order was a creation of an intelligent being that had then imprinted some of his own image on humanity was what gave him confidence in the scientific project as a whole. And I think I can go even further in saying that when we think about reason and science, they rely on many non-scientific assumptions. Most foundational will be that with our senses, we can access reality. And if you have ever taken a modern philosophy course, you will know that's not something you can take for granted. But also that the word is what our senses can access, that the word itself is reasonable and intelligible, and that those things are just taken for granted without, you cannot prove those things scientifically. The scientific project relies on them. And if we're now the Christian scientist who knows that we're created in the image and likeness of God, we should expect to have minds that are ordered towards deciphering the truths about this created order. Okay, so final objections. Are science and the Catholic Church compatible? So it's just, you know, the historical portion of the talk, which will be very short. First of all, the university is a Catholic creation. So you are here not because there has been an ongoing war between religion and science, but because there has been an ongoing collaboration between religion and science that stretches back into the Middle Ages. And this is most obviously seen if you go to one of the great medieval universities. Here's a picture of Cambridge. The scientific revolution, which is often pictured as the sort of great uprising against medieval theology, was led by some of the most sort of pious Christians of their time, or at least some of the most theologically interested people of their time. Some of them had somewhat interesting theological ideas. But Copernicus was not one of them. Copernicus, as far as we know, is a perfectly orthodox Catholic religious. And you can see that in this painting that they actually show the church that he worked at in the background. And he was far from the only one. Many of the great minds of the scientific revolution, they write very clearly about that the reason that they are doing this science, that they believe it's going to work, is because they know that God created the universe and they want to understand him better. We have already met Galileo, who was, of course, a Catholic scientist. Here we have Copernicus, Lemaître, four others that you have probably, or like some of them you have probably heard of, that each sort of founded different fields, Descartes, Mendel, Pascal, Steno. And this was mostly happening either during the scientific revolution or Gregor Mendel, also a little bit later in the 19th century, father of genetics. But where I want to end, so this sort of finishes the responding to the objections part. And where I want to end is go beyond just answering the question, can science and religion be compatible? Because we have much more expansive statements, both in the Bible as well as in our tradition, about the relationship between the study of creation and our understanding of the Creator. So in the Old Testament, we have multiple statements, but I like this one from Isaiah because it doesn't just say that the universe is ordered, but it's ordered towards good. So that means that there, like, this is going to be something we want to keep in our minds. But it says, "For thus says the Lord, the creator of the heavens, who is God, the designer and maker of the earth, who established it, not as an empty waste that he created, but designing it to be lived in. I am the Lord and there is no other. Or in Romans, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. So what both of these are pointing towards is that by studying creation, we can start getting to something as some understanding of the creator and of his providential care. Aquinas says it even more strongly in one of my favorite chapters of the Summa Contra Gentiles, that meditation on the divine works, so think about the created things, is indeed necessary for the instruction of faith in God. And that's what I sort of briefly want to cover, sort of his arguments there. But I think one reason to, like one intuition to have is, again, returning to Tolkien. If you wanted to get to know Tolkien, there are a couple of ways you could go about it. You can maybe talk to some of his still living relatives, like grandson. That would be one way to try to get to know him. You could maybe read some of the things that he, like the letters where he's talking, where he's saying, like directly what he believes, what he did that day, and so on. That would be a very good way. But another way would be to read Lord of the Rings. There's going to be some things that you learn about Tolkien by reading Lord of the Rings that you would not learn by reading his letters or talking to his grandchildren. And I think when we're thinking about studying creation, there is something similar going on. And what is, I think, really beautiful, that sort of modern science, whether we think about biology or physics or astronomy, has revealed to us, is that it seems like at all levels of creation, we have something like the unfolding of a story with a clear beginning and then sort of different stages and interesting twists in the plot. But what Aquinas says more directly is that there's at least four reasons why it is necessary to study creation to get a proper understanding of God. The first one is that it gives us a better appreciation of God's wisdom. So what Aquinas says is that for things made by art are representative of the art itself, being made in likeness to the art. Now God brought things into being by his wisdom, wherefore the psalm declares, you made all things in wisdom. Hence, from reflection upon God's works, we're able to infer his wisdom, since by a certain communication of his likeness, it is spread abroad in the things that he has made. I am obviously going to use a couple of astronomical examples, but we see the incredible sort of order and sort of that the whole universe, like the fact that, as far as we can tell, the same laws operates on all scales of the universe, like here, as well as 15 billion years ago and 15 billion light years away. This is amazing. Like that kind of sort of order and providential care. Second one. It leads to admiration of God's sublime power. For the power of the worker is necessarily understood to transcend the things made. And so it is said, if they, namely the philosophers, admired their power and effects, namely of the heavens, stars, and elements of the world. So I love that even in Aquinas' time, so it was space was the ultimate test to what is the most sort of impressive and powerful. Let them understand that he that made them is mightier than they. And if you want sort of an extra Lenten reflection to add to your discipline, my favorite one is to try to sort of both, like, to imagine at the same time, sort of the whole cosmos sort of unfolding over time, this sort of almost dizzyingly large universe that we live in, and God stepping into the world as a baby. I mean, I think that is something that most of the time managed to break me out from whatever sort of sloth I am in. And I think when we look at sort of what the contemporary astronomy has given us is really an icon of God's infinite power, and that we should realize how much more impressive is the creator of this universe. Third, it incites the love of God's goodness. When we see the goodness, the beauty, and the delightfulness of creatures, then how much more so is the creator of all that we see? And the whole reason I had turned off the light earlier on was to show some of the most recent images that we're getting from the James Webb Space Telescope that just shows what a beautiful world we live in. He didn't have to make it this pretty. And I think it is just one of these, one of the ways that I think science really helps is it sort of keeps that sense of wonder alive of what a marvelous creation that we live in. This is where it looks like where stars are born. But the final one is in some sense the most radical. But it endows man with a certain likeness to God's perfection. So by knowing himself, God beholds all other things in himself. Since then, the Christian faith teaches man principally about God and makes him know creatures by the light of divine revelation. There arises in man a certain likeness of God's wisdom. So it is said, but we all, beholding the glory of the Lord with open face, are transformed into the same image. So it's by trying to understand the created order around us and see it as God sees it, that is one of the ways that we are divinized, which is, I think, a beautiful place to put yourself to, in some sense, allow your love for creation to allow that sort of catch you up into the Trinity. But as we are in Lent, I thought it is good to end our place of humility, which is like where, like one of the places that this should bring us to is with a psalmist to ask that, when I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars that you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? And then with Easter, I claim with the same psalmist, yet you have made him little less than a god, crowned him with glory and honor. And with that, thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.